Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in this hour, you'll hear from Silas House on his new book, Lark Ascending, and NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg's with us on her new book about her longtime friendship with the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both coming up in part two of this edition. First, the Biden administration's student loan relief plan absolves hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians of their student debt, according to the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. That's a pro, but are there cons? Here's Eastern Standard education contributor Bridget Blom.
Kentucky's educational attainment and the growth of the state's economy are inextricably linked. In fact, data show Kentucky's economic growth lags the nation, and much of the reason for this is lower than average education levels. Michael Clark is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research, housed at the University of Kentucky's Gatton College of Business and Economics. He is also the former chief economist for the Kentucky Legislative Research Commission. In these roles, he has conducted applied economic and policy research on issues related to Kentucky's economy and the workforce. Dr. Clark, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, we've heard a lot the past week about the issue of student loans and the decision by the Biden administration to forgive up to $20,000 of student loans. There are very different views of the impact of the forgiveness program coming from Republicans and Democrats. As an economist and policy researcher, what do the numbers tell you about the likely impact?
Well, I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about some of the numbers, although we've got a pretty good sense of how much debt is out there and, you know, how much could potentially qualify for the student loans. When we start thinking about the different types of benefits and costs that this could impose on the economy, there is some uncertainty. And so those are the things that, it might be particularly important for us to talk about. But when we go through and we look at, different types of policies, it's really useful for us to kind of think about what are the benefits, what are the costs, and, you know, who those benefits and costs accrue to. So when you look at the student loan forgiveness program, obviously there's a clear benefit to the borrowers. That's going to be a tremendous amount of debt that's going to be relieved for them. We know large amounts of debt has some really strong negative impacts to individuals. You know, it can damage their credit score. It can make it difficult for them to buy a house. It can even affect employment. And so for them, this is going to be a pretty significant improvement in their economic situation.
And then how about, you mentioned the borrower, the kind of immediate impact to them of the forgiveness of $10,000 to $20,000 worth of debt that they're carrying. How do you see that kind of as a means to improve their economic situation? When folks say this is likely to increase, you know, a borrower's ability to really get ahead, how do you think about that or look at that as an economist?
Well, you know, I think generally, in terms of the debt, you know, the idea here is that they made an investment, and you know, they still, you know, investment in college. You know, they were borrowing for college. That debt reflects an investment that they were trying to make. And so, when we look at this, we start trying to think about how their situation is going to change. And for the individual who had borrowed money, this makes for a substantial improvement in their situation. But I do think it's important for us to kind of think about the costs that are potentially involved in this as well. And there are a few things that are concerns that I think economists have. And one of the big ones is, you know, what this means going forward. So when we think about student loans, I think it's useful for us to kind of reflect that or recognize that student loans, while they've been growing, while this has been a significant concern for policymakers for some time, student loans are not necessarily a bad thing, because what it does is it basically provides them an avenue to make an investment in education that can have long-term dividends. And so, you know, what you might have is an individual, in the absence of being able to borrow, they may not be able to attend a college or a university, improve their education. So the student loan basically is a way to kind of fund that. And then ideally, you know, they would earn maybe a higher income or have a better quality of life as a result of that, and go on to be able to pay that student loan. Of course, there can be problems as well, though, when people borrow too much, more than they can afford, or maybe they make investment decisions. You know, they attend college or maybe get a degree that doesn't improve their income as much as they had anticipated. And as a result, they end up either with no degree or a degree that doesn't provide the type of income that they would need to pay that money back. And then it becomes a real burden for them because, you know, they just struggle to be able to pay that back. So one of the concerns that economists have been talking about a lot with this, and it's a concern I share, is what we call the moral hazard. So the idea is what this policy is going to do is it's going to eliminate this debt, and, you know, so it's going to help those individuals. But the concern is going forward, when we see that this debt has been forgiven, we might see future students looking at this and trying to make this decision about, well, how much money should I borrow, you know, as I'm thinking about making my investment in my education? And if we have some expectation that the federal government might forgive student loan or student debts again in the future, then there's a strong incentive for them to borrow even more. And so what it just does is it kind of creates a situation where we've provided a signal, you know, that we might be willing to do this in the future, and we might actually encourage greater levels of borrowing rather than solving the affordability issue associated with education.
Okay, great point. So not so unlike thinking about the housing or small business loans, it's important to know how much of a loan you're taking out and what you're investing it in and what the return on that investment might be. And then being really thoughtful about the cost, the price of what you're purchasing, in this case, the price of education. And so we've heard a lot, I think, in the discussion the last week about the student loan issue. A lot of folks have come back around to the affordability of higher education. You've kind of watched this happen in Kentucky as maybe affordability has decreased. The price tag for tuition has really increased over time.
Yes, certainly, you know, we've seen evidence of that, you know, and it's not, you know, unique to Kentucky by any means. This is a national issue. We see this going on all over the place. You know, more people are investing in education as public funding for education has declined. We have seen the cost of tuition and the cost of other related fees increase as well, particularly as public funding for education tends to decline. That has to be made up somewhere else, and so that typically is made up through tuitions. And so that does affect the affordability for families and students looking to invest in higher education.
So, Michael, another thing you might look at as an economist is the impact to the community. As debt is forgiven and individuals have more money in their pocket, they use that money to maybe consume goods and services. So we call that an economic multiplier. When it comes to this forgiveness program, do you see much of an economic multiplier as a result of this forgiveness?
Well, I think there's certainly some, but I think when we start talking about the economic spending or the multiplier effect, we also have to talk about what effect that could potentially have on inflation as well. So one, when we talk about this large amount of debt that's going to be forgiven, I think it's important to put it in perspective, that this is debt that is going to be paid out over a long period of time. So while we're talking about, you know, I think the information brief from the White House was talking about $1.6 trillion in debt. I'm not sure how much of that would be forgiven, but that's not going to basically result in $1.6 trillion in additional spending immediately, right? You know, people are paying a little bit of that over time. And so it's not nearly as large as the amount of, the stimulus effect is not nearly as large as the total amount of debt that's going to be occurring. It's going to be spread out over a long period of time, basically. So I don't know that it's going to have this huge impact in terms of stimulus. But the other side of that is, okay, well, if it does have kind of a stimulus effect that, you know, it puts or basically allows people to not pay that debt service because it's been forgiven, and they can then go out and spend that in the economy somewhere else, that could put some upward pressure on inflation. But generally, because we're talking about, you know, kind of, you know, this small reduction each month that's going to be spread out over a long period of time. My expectation is that this wouldn't have a huge impact in terms of stimulus, and it also probably wouldn't have a huge impact in terms of inflation.
But it is important to understand the intersection of those two variables, I guess, as we think about the impact of a policy. So what stimulus effect might it have? What might it do to inflation, particularly at a time when inflation is increasing? And untangling those things as we have public conversations about the impact of a particular policy or investment decision is important. So I'd like to bring us back to kind of the low educational attainment piece. As we think about the importance of increasing educational attainment in Kentucky, we certainly want folks to go on to higher levels of education and to use those higher levels of education in the economy. However, you know, we know that low educational attainment hold Kentucky back when it comes to economic growth and arguably quality of life. So as an economist, when you approach these issues, what process do you go through as you think about the need to improve Kentucky's education outcomes and what that means for public investment or public policy strategies?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, educational attainment is something that Kentucky is lagging behind on, and it has a lot of different types of effects. You know, not only does it have an effect on us personally, you know, an individual who doesn't go on to pursue higher education is likely to have lower income over their lifetime. Individuals with less education might see different types of quality of life issues, and they're also at greater health risk. So, you know, there are some pretty significant benefits to investing in higher education that we as an individual might see, and it might motivate us to invest in education. But we also can kind of think of education as a public good. The idea that when I'm making a decision about how much education I should invest in, I'm thinking about how it might affect me, how, you know, how much it might cost in terms of my time and effort to get an education. But there are public benefits to education as well. And here the idea is that if people invest in education, then we see some pretty significant benefits across society. We see reduced crime rates. We see higher labor force participation. And these are things that help society in general. And so as a result, you know, there is a role for the public sector to play in terms of funding education so that we can achieve some of these improvements. So when we think about education, I think it's really important for us to kind of think about what are kind of those broader social impacts, not just how it affects us individually, but how it affects us as a society, and think about what is that optimal level of investment? What is that optimal level of funding?
And being mindful and wise when we make policy decisions and investment decisions, that those strategies are actually going to return on that investment to the individual and the state, clearly.
That's correct. One of the things I always keep in mind is that when we talk about education, we can talk about it very generally and I think have broad agreement that there are some significant benefits to improving the overall level of education in Kentucky. That's not really a controversial statement. Where we start to see disagreements is when we start thinking about what are the individual policies that would then get us there. That's where it really starts to become a bit more of a challenging situation is how do we go through and think about where we should make our investments, what type of investments should we make, you know, what type of administration should we have. And really, as a researcher who looks at public policy issues, the main thing I would point out is that we look at programs where there is some evidence of returns. You know, it's not to say that we can't do new programs, but as we're looking at these different types of programs that we hope will have some type of an impact on educational attainment, we look to those that have some research evidence that they actually work, and we prioritize those types of programs. And so it's really just kind of a matter of going through and trying to figure out exactly what does work and what doesn't work and then allocating the resources appropriately.
And having conversations like these is so important. Dr. Michael Clark, Director of the Center for Business and Economics Research, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bridget Blom is President and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. And by the way, Jill Midkiff with the state's Finance and Administration Cabinet has told the Lexington Herald Leader that, contrary to reports, student loan borrowers in Kentucky will not be hit with a surprise state income tax bill for savings realized through the Biden administration's student debt relief plan. The Breonna Taylor and George Floyd tragedies shook this country. Their deaths are a reminder that the fight for equality and fair treatment continues. For more than a half century, one leader in the black community in Kentucky has led the fight for racial justice. WEKU's Sam Dick has spent some time with PG Peoples Sr., now dealing with a very personal life and death struggle.
A frail, very thin-looking PG Peoples Sr. walks with a cane into a room about the size of a small classroom at Baptist Health Physical Therapy in Jessamine County. Scattered about are exercise machines like a recumbent bike and a balance beam.
How are you feeling this morning?
Good. I wake up kind of tired.
I am stunned by his loss of weight and weakness. It's been a few years since we've talked face to face. We first met about 34 years ago, and over the years, he's kept me updated by phone on his health challenges.
In 2004, I had my first diagnosis of breast cancer. I remember I was shaving one morning with my shirt off, and I noticed the left nipple was inverted, and I knew that wasn't right. So I went.
People says he immediately went to the doctor and soon after started chemo. He thought they had stopped the breast cancer, but it came back last year. And if that wasn't enough to deal with, he had surgery for a brain tumor last year. Giving up is not how he's wired.
I think it's just kind of part of who I am. All my life I've been a person that says, go get it. And I figure if I can beat it, I can light the path for other people.
His path has been full of potholes. He took a hard fall in June and is learning to walk again. Today, Melissa Wilson, his physical therapist, gives him some direction to help him relearn how to walk and keep his balance.
All right, well, let's get warmed up here on this machine. And then after we get warmed up, we'll work on some balance stuff.
Okay? As he fights cancer, the Urban League is getting ready to celebrate the life and legacy of PG Peoples at the league's banquet next month. Peoples has humble roots in eastern Kentucky. He's the son of a coal miner, and he has served 53 years advocating for low-income families in housing, education, and the workplace. And as the CEO and president of the Urban League of Lexington Fayette County, he's led the fight for civil rights. Sam Dick talked with two longtime friends and civic leaders about how Peoples has helped thousands.
Welcome, Dr. C.B. Akins, Pastor Emeritus of First Baptist Bracktown in Lexington and close personal friend and pastor to P.G. Peoples Sr. for over 30 years, and Jim Host, longtime good friend of P.G. Peoples going back almost 40 years. Host is the founder of Host Communications, two-time cabinet head under two different governors, and now dedicated to working on nonprofit projects for the benefit of Lexington and Kentucky. Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Dr. Akins, there's so many places we could start with this, but let me begin here. What has impressed you in general about PG Peoples after 53 years with the Urban League of Lexington Fayette County?
Well, obviously it's his unselfish desire to make Lexington a better place and to always be a voice for the marginalized, to speak up for those that don't have the advantages that some others may have. He never forgets where he came from and the struggles that he had early on in life and his family. And just the kind of person that you want to be aligned with if you're really fighting for making Lexington a better place for all of its citizens.
He is all about action, isn't he?
Well, you think about affordable housing, which is one of the big issues that any metropolitan area has, and it is a key issue here. He hasn't just talked about it. He's performed. And in the period when he started, he has built 272 units worth $27,939,000 since 1986. And he's done it with a guy by the name of Norman Franklin, who just retired, who is another very unassuming type of a guy like PG. You would never know what they've done, and yet he has so much pride in it. Ed Holmes has been involved with it since almost day one. And he's got senior multifamily units. He's got single-family rental units. And he has had 161 of the units that now are in home ownership from people who he has shown a way through rent, through income, and so on. And he's financed all of this through a nonprofit corporation that he and Norman set up and that the Urban League set up. And it's all been done by the Urban League, all been done quietly. A lot of people have no clue how much impact they've had.
What is it about his personality, the way he talks, the way he carries himself, where he's able to probably bridge some walls and obstacles, but still make his point clear, but also find some agreement, or at least people will listen to him?
Well, he's certainly not an overbearing person. He doesn't force himself. It's almost a Maya Angelou situation where you really couldn't understand why anyone would deprive themselves of the benefit of knowing the PG Peoples. He just has a magnetic personality. He's always looking to find something important about the other person and never seeking attention for himself. And so he makes everyone around him feel important. When you get to know PG, you find out how important he is because he virtually knows everybody worth knowing.
He's changed lives, obviously, by the hundreds, if not the thousands. Tell me what that means to you as a friend, but also as a pastor.
Well, there's an old saying that water does not have to gather around a tree to bless the tree. The tree's blessed just by the water flowing by. And PG has always been, as long as I've known him, the kind that sought to use whatever advantage he had for the advantage of the disadvantaged. And he'd get blessed in the process, but that was never his number one intention. It was always about uplifting the downtrodden. And so for him to come alongside me in ministry when I was new to Lexington in 1983 was a godsend for me. I did not know Lexington. I did not know who the players were. PG knew virtually everybody and started getting me on different boards and getting my church connected in the community, and just really made a difference in my life and the life of First Baptist Church Bracktown. I do not believe, seriously, that we would be the church that we are now and have had the impact on this city that we've been blessed to have if it had not been for connections with PG Peoples.
You're listening to Pastor C.B. Akins and Jim Host on the legacy of PG Peoples Sr. From a personal face-to-face relationship with him, what are the qualities that perhaps some people don't see that you know so well?
Trustfulness, believability, sincerity. There's a lot of people that talk a big game but never get anything done. He doesn't talk at all, but he gets it done. And I've been in meetings with him where he'll come in very unassumingly and sit never at the head of the table, but always at his side or at the end of a head of the table, you know, not like he's in charge, but instinctively, if he's in the meeting, people listen to what he has to say. And he takes over the meeting by how he commands the room. And he does it without ever raising his voice.
In the last 50 years, are there many people that match the impact that he has had on so many people? You just gave us some wonderful numbers, but where do you put him? Is he an all-star?
I think he's one of the five greatest Kentuckians of all time as it relates to what he's accomplished and what he's done. He just got an honorary doctorate from the University of Kentucky. He's one of the first African-American graduates from the UK. Think about a guy who grew up in a segregated school, who was a star quarterback in high school, who the school became integrated, and he all at once he lost his job, but he still played.
He talks about how a lot of progress has been made in civil rights, equality, and so forth, inclusion in this country, but also talks about the fact that there's still a ways to go, and that there are times when the wagon slips back down the hill, and you've got to be prepared to push it back up. Can you speak to that kind of philosophy that he has?
Well, if some folk would say, well, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. And I would counter by saying, PG Peoples didn't get the contract. Had he, it might have been. And so he's one that looks at things that others see as barriers, and he sees challenges. And challenges are things that we are to overcome, not to give into. And so for him to have been such an integral part of what happened in Lexington with the education system, with the hiring of the first African-American police chief, with the breaking down of a major bank in our city that was not being equitable with people of color, for him to be head of the Equity Council and to go on to be president of the KCTC board. I mean, these were positions that aligned with who he was. It's not the man that makes the times. It's the times that make the man. Mm-hmm. And so he rose to the occasion because he was there, I believe, on assignment by God for such a time as this. And he did it willingly, giving God the glory for everything that he did and looking for no credit to himself. And so that kind of a person that is willing to sacrifice of himself or herself for the greater good of others, I mean, that's a rarity, and we should all celebrate that.
I'll give you the final word. Any final thoughts?
For a guy to be in the same position for 53 years, longest serving Urban League head in the United States, so highly thought of nationally, that he has been called in for searches for other Urban League heads. He was a mentor for Sadiq Reynolds, who has done an outstanding job in Louisville over the last 7 years, but he was her mentor. And he's been a mentor to so many, and he's had a hand in selecting Urban League heads in other places. But his calmness, his ability to be able to calm the storm, has been one of his greatest assets.
Gentlemen, thank you. Jim Host and C.B. Akins, we appreciate your insight on PG People Senior. This is Sam Dick for Eastern Standard on WEKU.
A salute to PG People Senior is set for October 24th at the Central Bank Center in Lexington. Tickets are available at 2022empowered.eventbrite.com. Coming up after the break, Tom Eblin with Silas House on the new book, Lark Ascending.
I like to write about people who are trying their best to be the best people they can under extraordinary circumstances. And these are the most extraordinary circumstances I've ever written about.
And NPR's Nina Totenberg on her book about her longtime friendship with the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the state of the court today.
I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg so far. There are many areas in which the court may well revert to the early 1900s.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supporting veterans through an honor flight to Washington, D.C. The public is invited to the Welcome Home celebration on September 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Bluegrass Airport. More at honorflightky.org. WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
One of the preeminent Kentucky authors of our times has a much-anticipated new book in the pipeline due for publication later this month, and he is Tom Eblin's guest for our series on Kentucky writers.
Silas House is the award-winning author of novels, short stories, and plays. He also writes music journalism and columns about current events for such publications as the New York Times and the Atlantic. In late September, Algonquin Books will publish his seventh and most unusual novel, Lark Ascending. House was born in Corbin and grew up in Laurel and Leslie counties. He now lives in Lexington and teaches Berea College, where he is the NEH Chair of Appalachian Studies. House's previous work has largely been set in Appalachia and the South, as well as in the present and recent past. But this new book is very different. Lark Ascending is set mostly in Ireland and in a frightening dystopian future in which human society has all but collapsed. Natural disasters caused by climate change have destroyed the world's economy and food supply. Nations are ruled by violent sects of religious fundamentalists and authoritarians. This novel manages to be both grim and uplifting, showing how humanity can prevail even under the worst circumstances. Here today to talk about Lark Ascending is Silas House. Silas, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, tell us about Lark, his family, and the plot of this novel.
Well, it is an unusual book for me, but they are an Appalachian family. it starts out in Appalachia, and then they eventually make their way across the ocean as refugees. To me, the book is about deep grief, and it grows out of a really personal deep grief that I've had over the last 7 or 8 years, losing people really close to me, and just trying to figure out how to navigate that. But also a sort of collective grief that I think many of us feel in seeing the demise of our democracy, the climate crisis, you know, things of that nature. But I wanted to boil that down to one person who has lost everything, yet he keeps going. Because when I was going through such deep grief, I think the thing that I always had to remind myself was, you don't have any choice. You don't have any other choice but to keep going. You know, you can be sad to the bone, but you have to keep going. And one way you do that is, you know, by finding the wonder and the beauty in the world. And so while it is a grim book, it is also about beauty and wonder and holding on to hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you sketch out a little of the plot? I don't want to give too much of it away, so I'll let you do that. But just kind of tell people kind of the basic action in the novel.
Well, it's an American family who's seeking sanctuary, not only from a climate catastrophe, but also from fundamentalist forces, insurrectionists. And they make their way to Ireland, where they believe there's a safe space in a place, a real place called Glendalough. And Glendalough is an old monastic settlement in Ireland. It's thought of as a thin place. In other words, a place where nobody can quite explain why it feels so good to be there. You know, it could be minerals that are underground. It could be magnetic forces. It could be that people have been praying there for 13 centuries. But it just sort of represents hope, a place to go to towards hope. And so it's a journey. It's an adventure story about a young man who's trying to get to that safe place. Meanwhile, navigating that deep grief. And along the way, one thing that really saves him is he encounters a dog. And there aren't very many dogs anymore. Pets have pretty much They're all gone because people couldn't take care of them. But this dog represents a lot of that hope and beauty and wonder. And I think many of us, you know, in times of great sorrow, we turn to the natural world and we turn to animals to help us through. And so he has this dog, and he also is looking to the natural world. So while it is different as far as time period and scenario, thematically, it's what I've always been writing about. I've always been writing about the natural world. I've always been writing about family, particularly created family. I've always been writing about beauty and wonder and survival, you know. So thematically, it all felt really similar to me. The thing that was challenging and also really gratifying was the world building and, you know, creating something totally new.
Mm-hmm. And you've been to Glendalough? I haven't. I know. It's
yes.
A really, really cool place.
I have actually walked the entire route that Lark walks in Ireland. Mm. He walks from West Cork to Glendalough. And that was really helpful, of course, to know exactly where he was all the time.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And, of course, there's always a good dog character in your books. I've seen many of them, at least.
Yeah, I mean, my last two books in particular really focus a lot on dogs. I think of, you know, to me, dogs represent the best or of goodness, you know.
I think, you know, lots of people have different animals, whether it be cats or dogs or horses or other animals. For me, it's always been a dog. I can never remember a time in my life when I didn't have a dog.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what do you hope readers will take away from this book?
I want readers to find hope in the book. I think that, you know, I hear people say a lot that things are just so sad and difficult right now on a global scale, and that there seems like there's so much sadness in the world. And so this is a book about a man who's encountering that, but finding the goodness, the beauty, the hope, the wonder. One of my favorite moments in the book, they're in the middle of the Atlantic on a pretty precarious boat, overcrowded with dangerous people, etc. Yet he sees this amazing sky, and he's able to sort of meditate on the beauty of that sky and center himself to get through this misery, you know. And it's one day at a time, you know, one step at a time. And I think, you know, to some degree, we're all doing that in one way or another. You know, we're all making it through the best way we can. I really believe that most people are trying their best to be the best people they can be. The people who aren't get the most copy, right? That's where most of the stories and the conflict and all that comes from. So I like to write about people who are trying their best to be the best people they can under extraordinary circumstances. And these are the most extraordinary circumstances I've ever written about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one kind of wild card in that is I think the whole, climate change is just something we have, it seems, so little control over. We just can't get that fixed. And it's just like, you know, this really shows how, because that's really what sparks so much of the disaster in this book, really, is just the things that we see on the news every night.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, when I can't rectify something, when something really troubles me, I have to write about it. And I think for me, one thing about climate change that's so mind-boggling, frustrating to me is that so many people just don't want to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, this is life. You know, how do you not protect your water supply, for one thing? It makes no sense. And people will say, you know, well, we got to have economy. Well, economy is not going to do you any good if you don't have any water. When it comes right down to it, I think all of us would choose our last drink of water over a job. I mean, that's extreme, but it's true.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, what kind of reaction have you gotten to the novel so far?
Well, you know, we're just starting to get our first reviews, and so far it's been really great. I'm hearing from booksellers and librarians, people that read the book before it comes out, you know. And a lot of people are really attached to the dogs. I'm happy about that. People seem to really be enjoying the journey aspect of it. I always wanted to write an adventure story. So it was really inspired by books like Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson, The Call of the Wild by Jack London, sort of those old adventure classics. You know, I had that in mind while I was writing it, but I also wanted it to be something totally different, new, and imaginative.
This is certainly a great adventure story. I think it will probably get you a lot more national recognition even than Southernmost did, which was a really big book for you. So good luck with that.
Thank you.
Once again, the book is Lark Ascending by Silas House, which will be published by Algonquin Books on September 27th. Silas, thanks for being with us today. And for Eastern Standard, this is Tom Evelyn of the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
Thank you so much.
She is known as one of the founding mothers of NPR, where her career as legal affairs correspondent has involved reporting on many, if not most, of the major legal actions and decisions of the last half century. She just published a book about her longtime friendship with the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And that brings Nina Totenberg to Eastern Standard from NPR in Washington. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Nina Totenberg.
It's my real pleasure to be with you.
So you arrived at NPR in 1975, and women were just beginning to hold significant roles as reporters and editors back then, and that included you and your NPR colleagues, Susan Stamberg, Linda Wertheimer, and the late Cokie Roberts. And although the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the centerpiece of your book, Dinners with Ruth, you also enlighten us about a generation of women struggling to level the playing field with men in the industry. What do you recall as some important ways things have changed and improved for women journalists today?
Well, at the time that I came to NPR, I was a print journalist. And every place I'd worked, I'd been the only woman or one of two occasionally. And when I came to NPR, it was a revelation because the majority of the people who worked at NPR were women, not just in reporting jobs, but even some executive jobs. And the reason, of course, was that they paid so little money at the time that no man would work for that salary. But we were a band of warriors, as it were. We were not looking to break the glass ceiling initially. We were just looking to get a foot in the door and have a chance to prove ourselves. And when I got here and there were all these women who had my back, it was a wondrous thing to behold. I guess you'd call us a part of the, we became the old girls network, essentially. And as we made friends outside of NPR who were beginning to succeed, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg was one of those, she too was part of the old girls network, not our journalistic old girls network, but the greater group of women who understood the challenges we faced and that we thought we could deal with.
Does your friendship with the late Justice trace back to those early years?
Oh, it does. When I was first assigned to cover the Supreme Court, and I was in my, I think, mid-20s, and I worked for the National Observer, I called her up because she filed a brief in a sex discrimination case. And I didn't understand the brief. It was her first Supreme Court brief. And I asked her a bunch of questions. We had an hour-long conversation. And that was the beginning of what ultimately became a long and intensely personal friendship over the years.
So you clearly hit it off in that conversation. What did you find early on that the two of you had in common?
Well, initially, we were just reporter and source. But gradually, over the years, we became first professional friends, then more personal friends, and then in the last years of her life, acutely personal friends, because in the last year of her life, our house was just about the only place that she could go. And it's because my husband is a doctor, he's a trauma surgeon, and he was her medical confidant, even though I never knew what they talked about. They would go off in a corner and talk, and he never told me, and she didn't tell me. And so I could maintain my my position that I didn't know anything that other people didn't know on my beat.
Well, I wondered about that. Was it tricky? Was it difficult to separate your work covering the Supreme Court from that friendship?
It wasn't, because the rules when you're covering the court are so clear. If you have a friend who's a Supreme Court justice, who's a sitting Supreme Court justice, and you ask about a case that's before the court and what might be going on, the likelihood is you won't have that friend anymore. The lines are very clear. You might have a conversation about a case years later and what influenced the justice's thinking, but you wouldn't get any dirt from behind the scenes. You would have an actual discussion about the finer points of law.
The subtitle of your book, Dinners with Ruth, is a memoir on the power of friendships. Tell us about the power that you gained and perhaps that Justice Ginsburg gained from that relationship.
You know, we all face our great blessings in life and our great challenges. And for example, my husband was really very, very sick for almost 5 years. And my women friends rallied to my assistance during all of that time. Cokie and Linda, all I had to do was call and say, I'm having a bad moment, and one of them was there at my side. Or if I had to have a meeting with doctors, one of them was there to take notes. And Ruth was always there to pick me up and take me someplace interesting or invite me to dinner at her house, her apartment, or at a friend's house she was bringing me with her, just to pick up my spirits. And I learned from that, and much more, that when you come to a crisis, there's nothing quite like doing what you're supposed to do. And what you're supposed to do is help your friends when they need it most. And what you get from that is that you will be paid back a million times over when you need it.
Well, your beat has long included the Supreme Court, so you've followed its evolution over these years. What is your perspective about the court's present-day ideological balance?
Well, I've never covered a court this conservative, and I've covered the court for many, many decades. It's likely the most conservative court in almost a century, about 90 years. And I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg so far. There are many areas in which the court may well revert to the early 1900s or 1920s. And I don't think we know how far the court is willing to go, but we know it's in a hurry. The 6-3 majority is in a hurry. And if one of them drops off on a particular issue, they don't need that vote. All they need is 5. And it's also a court that I think gets along not at all well. I mean, I don't think they're screaming at each other or anything like that. I think, however, that they don't trust each other anymore, certainly not after the leak of the abortion decision in May, which was unheard of up until then. And I think the atmosphere of the court and the sort of the conservative majority being, somebody's called it the YOLO court, you only live once. It's almost as if these conservatives think they're only going to be around for a few years because they're very aggressive about reaching out to decide issues that don't need to be decided yet. And so from that point of view as well, this is a fascinating story that's unfolding. And I am looking forward to covering it because it is so interesting.
Does all of this raise concerns for you about the state of our democracy?
You know, it's not for me to tell you what kind of a court this country ought to have. There are plenty of things about which I think I could fairly say are alarming, including, you know, the invasion of the Capitol on January 6th. I thought I would never see something like that in this country, that was only for banana republics. And I worry about the safety of voting rights and the ability to recruit enough people to man elections because there's so much antagonism toward election officials. Those are things I'm perfectly well prepared to say. But who wins, who loses, what kind of ideology the court should have, that's not my job. My job is to tell you what they're doing.
Well, you've now done dozens of interviews about your career, your relationship with Justice Ginsburg, and your book about that relationship. And during this time, I'm wondering, as you've been asked to reflect and recall, have there been any revelations?
I'm not sure there have been revelations. I guess there were some, you know, when you write a book, you have to think about what friendships have meant to you. And they are an essential part of my life. They're as important to me as my profession. Because friendships, of course, include my husband's, my late husband, and my husband, hopefully now forever, Dr. David Rines. And so I think that friendships are the yin to the yang of a life in journalism. And I guess we should say you can buy the audiobook and listen to it if you have a long drive, because the voice you hear will be mine.
We should say that. And thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, bye-bye.
That's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, author of Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships, now available at your favorite booksellers. We have a sneak peek at what's in store for next week's edition of Eastern Standard.
The for-profit model that sustained these newspapers has basically collapsed.
Penny Abernathy, a visiting professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and author of News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, Will Local News Survive?
Where the loss has been greatest has been in small and mid-sized communities. These are the very communities that have relied on local newspapers for almost 200 years to both provide the news that helps residents make everyday decisions, as well as the news that binds us all together, you know, that shows us how we're related to someone we might not know in our own county or in another part of the state and share the same problems and issues so we can come together and solve them.
The state of local journalism, what's at stake for our democracy, and the possibility of reviving the local news landscape on next week's program, along with new music from Tiffany Williams.
I am a coal miner's daughter, proud as the mountain top pines, living in a body that has never been brought low by entering the mouth of a mine. I come from a long...
And what can be learned through music about the many international cultures finding a home in Lexington? It's an ongoing question here, and next week's focus is India.
Yes, so my name is Bhavani Goodlavaletti. I just completed my first year in med school at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, and I'll be entering my second year.
My name is Vasundhara Bhaskar. I've lived in Lexington, Kentucky for now about 20 plus years.
Bhavani and Vasu have been by our studio for conversation and to share samplings of traditional styles of the music of India performed today in our region. Here's Vasu.
Gam Ganapate Namo Namo Shankari Tanaya Namo Namo Gam Ganapate Namo Namo Shankari Tanaya Namo Namo Gam.
What's happening with local news, the music of India being performed in the bluegrass, and more on next week's edition. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.